content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. Our first article today is by Michael Venutolo Mantovani, dated October 3rd, and it is called Medicine by Design, a sharp dresser and an unabashed evangelist of hope, Duke Professor Dr. Richard Bedlack built a research and support network for patients with ALS. The first thing you notice are the clothes. How could you not? Snake print pants woven from a shiny silk. A rust brown suit jacket with patchwork prints stitched on its sleeves and back panel. Thick alligator skin boots. Heavy Roy Orbison style designer glasses whose lenses fade from dark to light. Hulking silver rings cover more than half of his fingers. One, a howling wolf's head, stands more than an inch of his tanned knuckle. Dr. Richard Bedlack is dressed beautifully, if not like a background character in a Tarantino flick. He's tall and slim, unfolding from the driver's seat of his Tesla, which is white and has yellow-orange flames painted across the hood. "I always wanted a real Hot Wheels car when I was a kid," he says. "Now I have one." But once you get past the clothes and start talking to the man, who is one of just 25 doctors worldwide working full-time on finding a cure for amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, you realize that the clothes are just window dressing, pun intended. Bedlack's outlandish wardrobe is far more altruistic than a pure expression of style. His clothes work as something of a red herring for his patients, meant to briefly take their minds off the fact that they are battling a disease that will more than likely kill them within a handful of months. But the clothes can only distract. They can't treat patients and they certainly can't change their mindsets. For that, Bedlack relies on his own indefatigable optimism and abiding embrace of the concept of hope. Bedlack believes that people, whether they're battling ALS or not, will always default to hope. That's how he explains the appeal of a clinic in Moose Jaw, Canada, that promised to cure anyone of ALS for as little as $75,000. Canadian media reported that patients were left disappointed. Although it's overwhelmingly documented that ALS is, at this point, an incurable disease, people staring directly into the horrors of ALS will look for anything. "If I don't give them hope, someone will," Bedlack told the Assembly. Bedlack says some of his contemporaries think he skirts the line between false hope and realistic options. But Bedlack says he is very clear with his patients that hope doesn't mean falsehood. He doesn't mean telling someone he can cure them of ALS. He probably can't. He knows that. His patients know that. In his years of research, Bedlack has found evidence of just 63 reversals of the disease's progress throughout the history of the world, reversals that some of those skeptics say are too abnormal to learn from. Instead of false hope or unfulfilling promises, Bedlack looks to his patients' lives outside of the disease, asking them to list three things they're hopeful for. Rarely do his patients say a cure. He does this because he knows that hope can work beyond the mythical, beyond the not easily definable. In fact, Bedlack said, people who are more hopeful have different brain patterns than those who lose hope. Their bodies are less inflamed. They tend to live longer. Some of that, he admits, is corollary. Hopeful people tend to live healthier lives, exercise, eat better, not smoke or drink. Still, from a clinician's perspective, these things are all interrelated. And in that sense, hope is a medicine. The cure is out there. ALS, colloquially known as Lou Gehrig's disease, is a progressive neurodegenerative disease that affects the brain's motor neurons. In short, it prevents the brain from talking to the muscles, impeding a person's voluntary body control. While it typically starts small and locally with muscle cramps, weakness in the hands or feet, or difficulty swallowing, the disease progresses quickly. The typical survival rate is 2 to 5 years. We don't know its cause, nor do we have a cure, and once a person has it, they typically only get worse. Some of the world's roughly 300,000 ALS patients far outlive that 2 to 5 year window. Some, like Andrea Peet, who has been working with BEDLAC for 11 years, go on to complete marathons in all 50 states. A very few others see a reversal of symptoms, something BEDLAC likens to a cure. How to harness that cure and apply it to other patients remains a mystery. For BEDLAC, no idea is too outlandish. This idea led him to start ALS Untangled, a database where he and a global team of more than 130 ALS clinicians from 11 countries compare and study alternative and off-label treatments submitted by other doctors, clinicians, and patients themselves. Its articles have been downloaded more than 500,000 times. ALS Untangled has brought a wider recognition to the idea that ALS patients are, as BEDLAC describes it, buying and trying things, and that doctors should be paying closer attention to what is being bought and tried. BEDLAC reasons that if doctors and clinicians are more open to alternative treatment ideas, it'll be less likely that ALS patients will trek to Moose Jaw, Canada, and fork over $75,000 to someone claiming he can do what no one else has managed. BEDLAC says the open approach of ALS Untangled helped him and his colleagues to pinpoint 8 promising alternative therapies for ALS. For BEDLAC and the other doctors and clinicians behind ALS Untangled, no idea is too outlandish, and the idea that the cure might lie somewhere out there in the universe is why one of BEDLAC's suit jackets bears the UFO on its back panel. For BEDLAC and the other doctors and clinicians behind ALS Untangled, no idea is too outlandish, and the idea that the cure might lie somewhere out there in the universe. Apologies, that's a repeat. BEDLAC has also worked with Manuel Cuevas, the legendary Nashville-based tailor who has dressed John Lennon, Dwight Eisenhower, John Wayne, the Rolling Stones, Elton John, Marlon Brando, Bob Dylan and Elvis, to name just a few. Cuevas' jaw dropped. He explained that he lost his wife to the disease 6 years earlier. "He's been my client ever since," Cuevas said, "and I've learned that he's so dedicated to his patients. But outside of his work, he's just a good person." A support network. BEDLAC's vibrant style is his trademark. If anything, it's by design, and it always has been. BEDLAC has dressed with flair for as long as he can remember. Growing up in suburban Cromwell, Connecticut, he used clothing as a shield to evade potential bullies. "Instead of kids taking my lunch money on the bus, they would laugh and say, 'What a nut this kid is,' and leave me alone," he says. He also noticed that his clothes, which BEDLAC describes as a suit of armour, helped brighten the moods of people around him. In addition to clothes, a young Richard BEDLAC was also fascinated by neurology. He would obsess over observations, wondering why he got dizzy after rolling down a hill, why a person shuffled their feet when they walked, or why someone's hand would shake when they wrote. He logged his questions and observations in a notebook that he would tote to a local library on the weekends. There, a librarian would lead BEDLAC to stacks of books that might help him better understand the brain's mechanisms. After studying at the College of William and Mary, BEDLAC returned home, hoping to save his middle-class parents a bit of coin, and enrolled in a highly competitive, fully funded neuroscience MD-PhD program at the University of Connecticut. After finishing, BEDLAC came to Durham in 1995 for his neurology residency, enticed by the programs Duke was building for patients with rare neurological diseases. It was halfway through his residency that BEDLAC first encountered a patient with ALS. He was fascinated by the disease, just as he was by the background given to him by his attending physician. He walked in and said, "This is what it's called. We don't know why it happens, and there's nothing we can do about it. All the patient can do is go home and get their affairs in order." And then he walked out, BEDLAC said. That extraordinarily brief history of ALS left an indelible impression on Bedlack, who almost immediately became obsessed. However, as Bedlack describes it, ALS is a net negative disease. By that, he means it loses hospitals, clinics, and universities money. And because of that, clinicians say, ALS research has historically been underfunded. Bedlack spent the next few years working in Duke's neurology clinic, only focusing on ALS one half day each month. At the time, patients were seen in Duke's Muscular Dystrophy Association clinic alongside people battling a wide variety of neuromuscular diseases. In 2001, Bedlack began soliciting donors and applying for grants to support a dedicated ALS clinic at Duke. Growth came slowly. After the first year, the half day per month of ALS research became a full day per month. By year five, Bedlack was focusing on ALS two full days a month, inching closer to working full-time on it. As his reputation grew, Bedlack's patients and those who studied his clinical findings began to evangelize in their own ways. Some started the Ice Bucket Challenge. Others raised hundreds of millions of dollars, and a few have spoken before Congress about the need for ALS research funding. By 2021, more than two decades after he started raising money, Bedlack was still only able to dedicate a portion of his work to ALS. The following year, a trio of families approached Bedlack with the hope of enabling him to research ALS full-time. The group was spearheaded by George Wendt, a Charleston-based entrepreneur who lost his father to ALS in 2013 after a nine-month fight with the disease. Wendt and Loy Stewart, a friend who also lost his father to ALS, had met Bedlack at a 2014 golf tournament. Like everyone else, Wendt and Stewart were struck by Bedlack's style. Like everyone else, they were soon struck by his approach to life and his message of hope. Within a year of their meeting, Wendt was corralling a group to start fundraising. "We have one of the best ALS doctors in the world only spending 20% of his time focusing on ALS," Wendt said. "I was absolutely outraged. I mean, we have a doctor who is ready, willing and able to spend full time researching ALS, a guy who would walk through fire to find a cure, and we have an institution that's ready to help him, but we can't find the dollars. Are you kidding me? That's a problem I can help solve." The group set their goal at $3.5 million, the interest from which, once invested, would pay part of Bedlack's salary, allowing him to research ALS full-time. Wendt and Loy partnered with Brent Hogue, who, after losing his stepfather, Larry Hughes, to ALS, started raising money through the Larry Vance Hughes ALS Foundation. Hughes' doctor throughout his battle with the disease, Dr. Richard Bedlack. By 2022, after tapping more than 500 donors, the trio hit their goal, marking the milestone with a celebration at the Chapel Hill Italian restaurant Il Palio. There, the three families who spearheaded the initial fundraising were joined by some 60 other donors. Several were joined by their loved ones living with ALS, while plenty of others didn't survive long enough to see the endowment. Bedlack, today the Stewart, Hughes and Wendt Distinguished Professor of ALS at Duke University, remembers it as one of the best nights of his life. Today, the Duke ALS Clinic counts two neurologists, a pulmonologist, a physician's assistant and 16 therapists and nurses, according to its website. The group currently treats more than 500 patients, making it one of the largest ALS clinics in the world. Since its inception, the Duke ALS Clinic has seen more than 5,000 patients from every corner of the world. Meanwhile, on the back panel of another of Bedlack's Cuevas suits is a shipyard, an eagle and a stack of books. Nods to the Stewarts, owners of a Charleston-based shipping company, the Hugheses, a family of avid hunters, and George Wendt, who teaches a course on leadership and politics at the Harvard Extension School. Ready to wear. In 2014, Bedlack was contacted by a world-renowned British fashion designer, Sir Paul Smith. Smith, known for his bold patterned clothing, learned of Bedlack's work, style and impact he had on his patients through social media and invited him to Paris Fashion Week. A few months later, Bedlack and his wife walked the red carpet alongside Smith, sat in the front row during his show and even took a turn on the runway before it started. Afterward, Bedlack and Smith cooked up a collaboration in which Smith would make ties for the coaches to wear during that year's heated Duke-UNC Chapel Hill basketball game. Its main feature was the blue cornflower worn in front of a national audience. Since then, Bedlack has collaborated with designers like Jerry Atwood, Union Western, Imp of the Perverse, Respoke, Standout Customs and Azure Works to create his custom suits. His newest partnership is with someone not nearly as well known. Sam Pierce is an ebullient young assistant professor teaching at North Carolina State University's textile department. Bedlack contacted her after one of his most stylish patients arrived for an appointment in an atypically subdued outfit. Asking what was wrong, he learnt that his patient's ALS had advanced to a point where her favoured ornate clothing became too difficult to manage for both her and her caregivers. Pierce was working on adaptive fashion, an approach to clothing and apparel designed specifically for people with physical disabilities and limitations. And Bedlack asked if there was a way for doctor and designer to collaborate. By the fall semester of 2024, Bedlack began connecting his patients with Pierce and her class. Her students would learn the patient's struggles and design clothes to make it easier for patients to dress more fashionably. A handful of students were interested for personal reasons. Their sorority's house coordinator had recently been diagnosed with ALS. Pierce's students often focused on closures, fasteners, buttons, zippers, using magnets, for example, to help patients struggling with motor dexterity. When this class starts out, we meet with the patients, Dr. Bedlack and his team, to learn about the challenges that are specific to ALS, Pierce said. But we also learn about what brands they like, because we want them to be able to still be expressive, to be able to wear clothes that they want to wear. Not all of Pierce's students participated in the ALS project. However, all of them interact with Bedlack during his monthly class visits. According to Pierce, Bedlack's effect on the students is the same as it is with seemingly everyone else. First, they obsess over his style, but what they're left with is his message of the power of hope. Keeping the faith. Bedlack doesn't go to his patients' funerals anymore. It's not that he doesn't mourn them. If anything, according to everyone interviewed for this story, Bedlack is known for developing a deep personal connection with most of the people he treats. In this way, he's unlike so many doctors, especially those who trade in the incurable. He wants to be there for his patients, for their families. He just can't. He used to. But standing above the coffins of his patients some years ago, Bedlack felt a burdening sense of failure. He didn't do his job, his life's work. Now, at 59 years old, that life's work is likely closer to its end than its beginning, though Bedlack said he has no idea when his career will be done. When asked if he'll consider his career a failure if he retires before finding a cure for ALS, his eyes swelled with tears. He said that unless he can for at least a subset of his patients, a large part of him will feel like he's failed. Still, he's proud of what he has accomplished, of the places, the practices and the outlooks he'll leave in his wake. He also finds solace in the fact that the professorship endowed by the Stewart, Hughes and Wendt families isn't his professorship. When he retires, the trust will allow someone else to focus full-time on finding a cure for ALS, building on the foundation that Bedlack and his team created over the last 20 years. True to his ethos, Bedlack remains hopeful, pointing to those 63 extraordinarily rare people who have been cured of ALS. The fact that it can happen tells me that we shouldn't just accept that the best we can do is slow ALS progression, he said. And if I believe that hope is important to my patients, if I believe that it's a treatment, then I need to find ways to stay positive, to stay hopeful. Next, we have an article from Greensboro by Sayaka Matsuoka. Eastern Music Festival may live again. The Eastern Music Festival will be dissolved as an organization, but supporters say there's a new path forward for the 64-year-old Greensboro tradition. The Eastern Music Festival will be dissolved as an organization after negotiations between faculty, artists, and the EMF board and staff broke down in the last few weeks. But faculty, artists, and supporters say they've identified a way to revive the yearly 5-week summer festival, which draws professional classical musicians and students from all over the country to Greensboro. The festival's board has decided to dissolve the 64-year-old music non-profit, it announced via press release Monday morning. EMF will soon begin work on ceasing its operations and identifying one or more suitable mission-aligned non-profits to which EMF will transfer its remaining assets, the board wrote. Conversations with EMF's board and staff members on Monday reflected a standstill during negotiations that led to the board's decision to dissolve the organization. At loggerheads. As the Assembly reported in August, the non-profit has been undergoing contract negotiations with its faculty members who voted to unionize in 2023. Afterward, the union, EMF's board and staff had been working to reach a consensus and continue the festival. But in February of this year, the EMF board cancelled the 2025 summer festival. That led the union to file an unfair labour practice charge against the organisation and landed EMF on the American Federation of Musicians International Unfair List. In late August, the EMF board and faculty artists resumed negotiations, but things hadn't moved forward, members of both sides said. Faculty members failed to offer any compromise on their intractable bargaining positions, despite knowledge of dissolution as a next step option and considerable efforts by federal mediators to bring the two sides together, the board wrote in its Monday release. It seems like we were at loggerheads with even the smallest things, Chris Williams, EMF's executive director, told the Assembly. We put together a good offer. When we said, "What's your counter?" it would go off into these really unusual tangents. It was not very germane and not very productive. The offer, which EMF's board made to faculty artists in February, included a base pay increase for artists and a housing stipend. But John Shaw, a musician with the Florida Orchestra and principal percussionist at EMF, said the increases would actually amount to a decrease because of new pay structures that don't take into account levels of seniority or numbers of individual students taught. Another sticking point, maintaining the current faculty size. For months, faculty artists have been pushing to keep their current number of 61 members. That would help keep the mission of EMF, teaching students and hosting a professional orchestra, intact, Shaw said. That's not something the board would agree to, Shaw told the Assembly. Basically, they said, well, if you can't get off of the idea that we have to leave the faculty size the same and you can't give up the idea of faculty that would play every Saturday night, we're going to dissolve the festival, Shaw said. And that's what was decided by the board, said EMF board chair Anne Starr Denny. In terms of programming and the students we recruit, we can't make a commitment to a specific number of faculty, Denny said. We need the flexibility to meet the demands of the students and the programs we have. We were unable to come to an agreement. It was a difficult decision, Williams said, but one he supports. This board took their responsibility with the utmost seriousness, Williams said. They considered all of the facts and they made a really tough call. I support that call. It is important for the organisation to maintain the number of faculty, many of whom have been teaching at EMF for decades, Shaw said. My question was always, how does cutting faculty or cutting out the faculty orchestra further the educational mission of EMF, Shaw said, which they didn't have an answer for. In a statement posted on Facebook, EMF faculty artists said they were saddened by the announcement of the dissolution of the festival and that they would continue to do everything within their power to keep that wonderful tradition alive. That dream may come true sooner rather than later, said some who have been working behind the scenes. An enduring model. While the faculty, artists and EMF's board and staff have been negotiating for the last 2 years, Barbara Morgenstern has been working in the background to find a different path forward for the organisation. Ex-wife of EMF's late founder, Shelley Morgenstern, she has been a staunch supporter of the faculty artists in the 2 years since they formed the union. In that time, she and a core group of funders say they have raised about $1 million to maintain faculty numbers and preserve the festival's model. Reached by phone on Monday, Morgenstern said she and the other funders have formed a new 501c3 non-profit under the name Eastern School of Music at Greensboro to continue the model her ex-husband started in 1961. While the name will likely be changed, Morgenstern said, the goal is to keep all of the faculty, give them raises and housing stipends, and keep the festival running. She is currently in talks with administrators at Guildford College to secure the campus for the 2026 festival, she said. Jerry Schwartz, the musical director of EMF, has agreed to stay on, Morgenstern said, and faculty artists are excited about continuing the work under a new organisation. They're excited about doing what they've done so well for 62 years. I think we have a real future if we can get our financial ship in order and not have this happen again. Morgenstern is currently chair of the new board, along with five other members who helped raise the $1 million. If they can secure their contract with Guildford College, she said they'll work on hiring staff and entering into negotiations with the faculty artists. Shelley Morgenstern, who died in 2007, would likely have mixed feelings, she said. I think he would be sad to see that it got to this point, she said, but I think he would be proud of me. I think he would be happy that we're seeking to bring it back in the same way he envisaged it 62 years ago. Morgenstern has reached out to the EMF board about acquiring the organisation's assets, she said, which include musical instruments, a music library, furniture, equipment and some cash. As part of the dissolution process, we will identify one or more qualified 501c3 organisations whose missions align closely with EMF's, said Anne Stardenny, chair of the current EMF board, ensuring that our remaining assets continue to support the education of young musicians in meaningful and lasting ways. We're very excited for the future, Morgenstern said. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.